Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer show, or on Twitter at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer WNYC. Somebody is watching you. It's true. And today on The Brian Lehrer Show, public and private, a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting. Are you in favor of privacy, of nobody watching you unless you want them to be watching you? What about openness? Are you in favor of openness? Oh, you are. How about secrecy? Does that sound more sinister than privacy? Is privacy good, but secrecy bad when it comes to the data you generate in your life? Or is privacy something for you to own and secrecy something that governments and corporations put on you? What about when it comes to your teenage kids? When they post something on Facebook, is it public or is it private? Maybe they consider it public for their friends, but private from you. And what about transparency? Should government be transparent about what it's doing? Should the companies you buy things from be transparent about what they're doing with your data? Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, we will try to make sense of the increasingly complicated world of private versus public information. Who should have information about you? When you should have information about your government, your business, your teenagers? Where does the private good meet the public good? An example one is your car. We posted the main questions on Facebook last night. One, how uncomfortable are you with technology in your car that stores information about how you drive, how often you speed, whether you turn without signaling, if you ever drive without a seatbelt, etc.? This information could be used by law enforcement in the case of a car accident. Again, how uncomfortable are you with technology in your car that stores information about how you drive, how often you speed, whether you turn without signaling, if you ever drive without a seatbelt, your steering angle, all that. Another way to look at it, question two, how uncomfortable are you with technology in your car that stores information about how you drive if you could use the data about your good driving habits to lower your insurance bills? More comfortable with that? Some of the responses we got on Facebook. Frank writes, I don't mind that my car does this. It already does. So long as the data is stored securely and kept private from advertisers and a warrant is required for law enforcement and federal agencies to access it. Eben writes, I am comfortable with it. I just read Social Physics, the book, and I get a sense of what is possible and what we can build. I think the net effect of reduced privacy will be better designed systems. Privacy is desirable, but maybe serves no end in itself. But reduced privacy toward better mortality and morbidity rates, toward more efficient traffic patterns, energy efficiency, etc., I think it's worth the trade-off, writes Eben. But Rob writes on our Facebook page, just because we have the capacity to do this doesn't mean we should. We as a society are going further down an Orwellian rabbit hole. And Josh writes, fine with me, but just because cops and insurers have improved info would not necessarily lead to more accurate enforcement and rates. And I'll tell you a story about this. Maybe you've seen it online. You know, the definition of a gaffe is when you blurt out something that's true that you didn't really want everyone to know, right? The Ford Motor Company's global marketing director, Jim Farley, committed a gaffe recently at a consumer electronics show when he said, we know everyone who breaks the law. We know when you're doing it. We have GPS in your car, so we know what you're doing. It was a little bit of an exaggeration, but basically true. And the world reacted with outrage and fear. Farley apologized, of course, for telling the truth, but the cat was out of the bag. What the Ford executive was referring to, and the reason I asked this poll question, is that starting later this year, each new car sold in the United States will be required to have these event data recorders I've been talking about, kind of like the black box you have after an airplane crash. It'll record your speed, your rate of acceleration, when you hit the brake, steering angle, whether your seatbelt is on, and more. Your car knows a lot about what you do to it already, and it will know more, and it will be required beginning with 2015 models. And as I said, the information can potentially be used by police or insurance companies in litigation after an accident, or to give you lower rates if you volunteer to share this data with them over a period of time if they set it up. They haven't set up that system yet. And of course, if that data indicates that you're a safe driver. So we're looking for some volunteers to call up right now and take a little further questioning in this automotive privacy poll. And why don't we start with Tim in Brooklyn. Hi, Tim, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. So I'll ask you the first question first, and then I'll go on to kind of a different way to put it. Are you comfortable with this idea, basically, of this event data recorder or the black box, if law enforcement could use it after an accident?
I think I am, actually. My first instinct is to say no, but for safety concerns, I think it could be a good thing.
Why was your first instinct to say no?
I guess I don't like authority. I don't want people to know too much about me.
Aha. Uh-huh. So new word introduced into it, authority.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an accountability or potential safety thing versus authority. Okay. Tim, actually, I'm going to leave that there. Thank you very much. So Tim's fairly comfortable starting out. Nancy in Manhattan, how about you? Hi, Nancy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Well, I think that with limits, right? So just to give you an example, the first time that my car dealer told me we got a reading from your car that it's time for an oil change, I was a little spooked by that, you know.
There's your Ford Motor Company guy, right?
Yeah, and so I felt very uncomfortable, and I even addressed that with them. I think that in terms of safety, it's a good idea. I think that, you know, if your car knows if your seatbelt is on, et cetera, all the good things that revolve around safety, I'm totally comfortable with that, but I think there have to be limits. I don't want an insurance company to know my movements. I certainly don't want marketers to know my movements. So I guess it's a yes with limits answer.
And with respect to the insurance company, if, as I said before, you could use the data, if you're a good driver, to lower your insurance bills, would that be enough incentive for you to allow your insurance company to have access to this data?
No, I don't think they need access to that because at this point, you can do that now, right? If GEICO tells me, well, given your driving history, we can offer you a lower rate, I think they do that, and I'm pretty sure they offer that right now based on your driving record. I don't think it's necessary to know how fast I drive in order to give me a break on insurance.
What if they could give you even a bigger break? Maybe they know now you don't have any points on your license, you haven't reported any accidents to them, but now they also know, oh, you use your seatbelt 100% of the time. They can measure that. You always signal before making a turn, before your steering angle goes to 90 degrees, and then your rate might get lowered even a little more than somebody else's.
I would turn off the feature. It wouldn't be worth the extra $20.
Okay, Nancy, thank you very much. Bernadette in Little Neck, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bernadette.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing? You have an excellent show.
Thank you so much. So you're comfortable with this requirement that's coming?
I'm very comfortable with it. You know, the children nowadays, I've gone through pulling my hair out as everybody turns 16, 17. And how many times can you tell each child, make sure your seatbelt's on, make sure you look before you go this? And, you know, it's just another way, I think, that, you know, they just have some other voice in their mind that can tell them, look, they're going to track to make sure that everything is okay, to run your insurance, to make sure you can save some money. They have a lot on their plate, too, not to miss an oil change. I think that's a great reminder in the busy world. And, you know, I've had an incident when the engine had a problem and the dealer tried to tell me, oh, you didn't come in for your oil changes. And I did get them at a gas station, but it was hard to go back and prove it all. So a little bit of extra help, I think it's fine. It's not telling you where you're eating dinner or if you had to tell a little white lie why you ran home late 20 minutes because you popped to a movie or something. But it's, you know, I think it's helpful, and it's good if you're going to get a break in insurance.
Sounds like you should call back later in the show when we're talking about parents and teens and their privacy. But let's up the ante. What about the idea that Mayor de Blasio is considering for his Vision Zero traffic safety plan, not yet a proposal but something they're considering, the black boxes in taxi cabs would transmit all that data back to a central location, and if a taxi speeds, then it would sound a warning to the passengers and turn off the meter or start charging a lower rate. You like that idea?
I like that idea too. As long as I don't have to open the door and jump out, I think it would be, I think it's a good idea. It teaches them a little bit more responsibility. You know, it's just everybody feels like, oh, they're watching me, they're this. But, I mean, the bottom line is if you teach responsibility and the more data you have for your personal self to say, you know what, if everybody kind of does the right thing, watches out for their children and their cars and their companies, it can only make things safer. I mean, what are they really going to use all this extra data for? I mean, if it's going to help people in taxi cabs, if the guy's a little nuts, I think that's a good thing.
Bernadette, thank you so much. People, are you all as down with this as Bernadette is? 212-433-WNYC. Eric in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. How about you?
Hey, Brian. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not really comfortable with this. I think that we better use the technology to make the cars better so we don't get into much accidents. And also, I'd rather use the money to fixing the roads instead of leaving all the responsibility to the individuals.
How about this scenario? After Toyota's problem with stuck accelerator pedals, remember that?
Yeah.
It caused a number of crashes. That's when the government proposed the requirement that all cars be equipped with the event data recorders that would automatically record speed, and one of the things is acceleration rate. So considering the Toyota problem, based on that story, does that convince you more that event data recorders should be required equipment to help reveal defects in manufacturing?
Yes. I mean, in the events, right. Like I said, I mean, to make the cars safer, yes, but to leave all up to the individual and how I drive and when I drive, I mean, we all have our moments. So one moment, let's say I feel a little tired, I don't drive right, they can use that against me, my insurance will go up.
But can you separate the two? Can you separate the two? Can you have a data recorder that would let you know if the pedal was sticking, not let you know, but let's say after a crash, they could tell that you were trying to brake, but the accelerator was still accelerating, but wouldn't report your failure to signal before making a left turn? Can you separate it?
Yes, of course. Of course, I'm all about safety. So if it improves the safety of the car, then obviously yes.
Then yes. Here's another one. The Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts, Tim Murray, claimed after an accident in 2011 that he was wearing his seatbelt and observing the speed limit. But the event data recorder in his car revealed that he was not wearing a seatbelt and he was going 100 miles an hour. So based on this story, should event data recorders be required in all cars to record driver behavior at the time of a crash?
Not really. I mean, I think we should be have a better education and better so then people will, you know, obviously improve their driving habits. However, at the end, it will be up to the individual. I mean, we can have all the laws you want. If I don't want to put my seatbelt, I'm not going to put it.
Eric, thank you very much. All right. He wants to slice it kind of fine there. Samantha in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, Brian.
So are you comfortable with the event data recorder requirement that's going to take effect this year?
Actually, really not. And it's funny because I work in public safety. I work as a paramedic. But so I'm 100% in favor of reduced pedestrians being struck by cars, reduced fatalities, reduced traffic accidents in general. But on the other hand, I feel like it's just an inherent violation of privacy.
Why?
I can't get over the idea that, you know, of not wanting everyone and everywhere to know my business.
Just as an inherent value, regardless of the public safety impact?
I think the public safety impact, there are a lot of other directions to come at it from. And I think I approve of a lot of the moves that de Blasio is coming up with for Vision Zero. I think changing speed limits, I think increasing traffic enforcement, particularly inside the five boroughs, you know, getting more cops out there, watching and issuing tickets. And I think that's what's going to change people's behavior and not necessarily a little black box in their car.
Who would be harmed by this data being out there? How do you think you might be harmed by this data being collected in your car?
I think for the vast majority of people, they wouldn't be harmed. That being said, I think I also have a right to go places and not have my car track me with GPS. And I think that it's an unnecessary step that can be misused. So I think there's a potential for people to be able to access it without my authorization.
And I should think, go ahead, sorry.
I think there's also been a huge trend towards warrantless searches overall in the U.S. I don't know necessarily how individual jurisdictions would handle searches of cars, but if, for example, if an officer asks to look inside of your vehicle and you say yes, does that mean they're now allowed to plug in quickly to your black box recorder and take a look at how you've been driving?
Mm, good question. And there's a bill in the Senate that would only allow them to do that with a warrant. And I guess they're going to debate that in Washington. How do you feel about the de Blasio taxi idea? And again, he's not proposing this, but they said this is one of the things they're considering so that the base, I guess, would know via GPS where the driver is at all times, how fast they're driving, and the passenger would actually either get a vocal warning or possibly even a lower rate on the meter for the length of time that the driver was speeding.
I think that's actually a very good idea. I think that once you step into a business modality, particularly with some of the atrocious behavior I've seen among cab drivers, and as a paramedic, I spend 40 to 56 hours a week out on the street watching how people work, you know, watching how people drive. And I've seen some just egregious traffic violations by cabs that haven't been caught or enforced.
Mm-hmm. So why shouldn't we all in general have an obligation to be transparent when we're driving on a public road?
I think there's a big difference between someone who's doing that professionally and someone who is doing that privately as a private citizen. I think if the public roads are the only way to get between A and B, then the burden that I as an individual bear to submit all of my information to my car manufacturer, the service center, and ultimately to the government by way of, you know, whatever enforcement or whatever search is sort of absurd. I think that in a more commercial sense, if you're going to be on the road that much, absolutely have GPS in the vehicle, absolutely track speeding. But I don't think for a private citizen it's A, necessary, or B, something I'm comfortable with.
Samantha, thank you so much for your call. Be safe out there.
All right. Thank you. Be safe.
And we go now. By the way, I should mention that my understanding about these black boxes or event data recorders that will be required in all or most all cars made in the United States as of the 2015 models is that they only retain the information for a short amount of time. So after it's obvious that you're not going to crash in, I don't know exactly what that time frame is, but that anything relevant to a crash could be in the box, you know, so maybe it's a few minutes, maybe it's even less than a minute, then it disappears. And it's, so it's measuring the present and retaining just the immediate past is my understanding. Phil in Roselle, you're on WNYC. Hiya, Phil.
Hiya, Phil. Good morning, Brian.
You comfortable with this?
No, I'm not. Not at all. I don't think that we should go down this slope. It's just more invasion of our privacy.
When you say privacy, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, whose business is it that how fast I'm going? Granted, there are speed limits, whether I'm signaling. It's just another piece of data that that can be obtained on the individual. And in terms of what they're doing, the cars record some of this information now with what they call the OBD2 system.
I think about 85% of cars on the road in the U.S. already have this. The change this year is that it's going to be required.
Yeah, it's after, well, it's actually all vehicles after 97 or 98 when they changed the onboard diagnostic system. So they can tell how fast you're going. But this is basically what UPS uses to track its drivers and whether they have the door closed and mm-hmm. whether they're making left turns and such. If they're going to do it, then I think they should require a warrant.
What about, collect it. How about collect it, and then in order to look at it, require a warrant because an event took place?
Well, that would be the compromise for me. I'm principled opposed to it. I don't see where it's going to be any good, where it's going to do me any good.
How do you feel about the taxis? Differently than
differently.
For private drivers, yes, because it's a commercial operation?
Taxis and commercial vehicles that use our roads to engage in their business should be required to behave differently.
Uh-huh. So what about this? And it sounds like you would want road safety. You're a Vision Zero fan, perhaps, that idea?
Yes, I am.
So what if everyone's black box data was routinely being transmitted to some city driver database? They're not proposing this, let me be clear, but the technology seems to allow it. So hypothetically, if everyone's black box data was routinely being transmitted to some city driver database and they could see that certain cars routinely speed in certain locations or certain cars routinely make left turns without signaling or routinely have passengers without seatbelts on or a driver without seatbelts, don't you hate those people? If knowing those things led to the police contacting those unsafe drivers to warn them or ticket them for repeated offenses, would that be a Vision Zero safety measure you would support as a preventive?
I wouldn't support it. Again, it's a question of privacy. I'm not comfortable with authority government having that much information on me or on other people. It's a slippery slope again.
Phil, thank you so much. And Judy in East Hanover, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi, good morning.
What are you thinking as you hear all this?
Well, I'm thinking that I would very much like to be comfortable with this, with this new requirement because there are so many benefits that can come out of it. But I think with a track record of trust that the government and big business has at this point, I would definitely, if I had a vote in it, say no, because the abuses are way too many for me to be comfortable with it, and that's a shame.
And do you feel differently about the taxi requirement, as some of the other callers who are skeptical did?
I do, but I think I would have to give it more detailed thought. I think because they are dealing with public safety, they're taking on that responsibility by taking someone in their cab, I would be more open to considering it. But, I think there are some abuses that can happen with that, too. So I would really have to give it more thought.
Judy, thank you very much. And Mike in Brooklyn, I think you're going to be our last caller on this. Mike, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. Yeah, so I am definitely in support of the black box, and I'm not surprised to hear that so many people aren't in support of it, because I feel like every time I'm walking to work, there's someone speeding or somebody, rushing through a stop sign. So
the principle behind it, in general, should we have an obligation to be transparent or also a right to be private about our driving?
Repeat that again?
Well, when you're driving on a public road, is the way you operate your vehicle public or private?
Oh, I think it's public. Not only is it, you're on a public road, but you're also operating a machine that I feel like takes greater skill than people realize. And so if you're not qualified or would rather not follow the laws that are passed, then you shouldn't have the right to operate this machine on a public road.
Right. And what about the distrust of authority to misuse the information, the government, the insurance companies, that we've heard from the skeptics in this segment? Does that prospect bother you?
Well, I guess in some ways it does, because you know, you could say that they would pass laws to restrict the use of the data, but we all know that information is used beyond our knowledge. You know,
So you're not entirely. You'd have some reservations.
So I have some reservations.
Even
and
though
there
you'd
would
come
definitely
down,
be
yes.
some things to work out.
And then would you go all the way? I'm curious to my ultimate scenario there, which is what if everyone's black box data was routinely being transmitted to some city driver database? As I was saying before, that hypothetically, if everyone's data was routinely being transmitted, they could see that certain cars routinely speed in certain locations, certain cars routinely make turns without signaling, routinely have passengers without seatbelts. And if they could see that thing at your local police precinct, let's say that person was you, and then they contacted you just based on the black box data and either gave you a ticket or a warning, would you be comfortable with that?
Well, I wonder if there's a way to encrypt it so that basically the data is deleted if you're not doing anything illegal. But then if you are,
as a method of them finding out if you're doing something illegal, you would be okay with that.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you very much. And thank you all for your calls on this. A great way to start our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting, public and private. The U.S. Senate, by the way, sufficiently alarmed by the Ford guy's remark that they know everyone who's breaking the law and by the whole thing, that they are now considering a bill in the Senate to make all that black box information that's going to be required by the federal government the property of the driver. It's called the Driver Privacy Act and would require that law enforcement have a warrant to get the data. So the debate about privacy and your car in the United States is just getting underway as the technology progresses. Up next, the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on privacy continues with example number two, privacy and your health. Ever hear of a social pulse meter? Stay tuned. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on privacy today. Example two, your health and your data. Not the big data the insurance companies and your doctors share about you or the government collects, not all that metadata, but the little data that your phones and cable boxes are already gathering. How mobile does your mobile phone know you to be? It's the idea of my next guest, computer scientist Deborah Estrin, that all that small data should come back to us to improve the health and well-being of our families and ourselves. She is recognized as a pioneer in networked sensing and one of the first professors recruited by the new Cornell Tech campus, and the co-founder of the not-for-profit startup OpenM Health. Professor Estrin, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
So first, networked sensing. Just explain that simple-sounding term, but difficult-sounding term for our listeners. Networked sensing.
There are all these devices and software tools that we use. They're disparate, and they, in a way, sense what we do as well as their primary purpose. And when we bring these data together, we can learn things in a more powerful way.
So is that like some of these devices that people know and have out there, like the Fitbit or one of the exercise or sleep apps available for smartphones?
It is. It's about the devices. It's about those apps you download. And it's about all the digital services you use. And we leave these digital breadcrumbs, these traces behind, sometimes because we're intentionally trying to measure something, but more often because we're just using a service.
Just inadvertently leaving digital breadcrumbs, you call them, about our health.
About ourselves, about our function, and what better way to understand something about our health?
For example?
So, for example, I might be trying to figure out whether acupuncture is actually helpful to chronic pain and can help me reduce the amount of ibuprofen or painkillers I take. Or, for example, to help to see if I'm on the right dose of antidepressants.
In your TED Talk, you discuss your 90-year-old father. Typical measures of heart health, like his EKG, hadn't changed, but his behavior had dramatically changed in the weeks before his death, and you realize that in hindsight. So what's the relevance of that story to this topic?
The relevance is that there are these key vital signs and medical measures that clinicians need to help to take care of us. But at various stages, we can't see the changes in the measurement of an organ, but we can begin to see changes in the way somebody functions. So in retrospect, my father's walks became shorter and shorter. He stopped buying groceries in the grocery store, all things that he barely was conscious of, let alone that he would tell to the cardiologist. What's the relevance of that? Would the cardiologist have prevented his passing away at the ripe and rich age of 90? No. But both my father and his family would have had a better idea of what was going on.
And you talked about wanting to measure his social pulse.
Yes.
Do you envision a device that can do that, like a heart rate monitor?
What I envision is that we can choose to run apps and services that help to give us measurements we want. And so maybe as an adult child of an elder parent, you'd like to keep have them share a social pulse. Maybe as a friend of another elderly person, you'd like to share your social pulse. So I see these as special apps and services, not so much as devices.
So our theme today is public and private. Do we need to reexamine our attitudes toward privacy in order to put this small data technology for the benefit of our health into widespread use?
I think, first of all, we need to establish a norm of having access to these data, that these data are not only for the MTA and for the insurance company and for the medical system, but these data are also should be there for us to use for our personal health management and our social and life management. So we have to have personal data APIs to get access to that data. And perhaps we need a safe harbor place where we can bring those data together and run apps over them, the ones we choose, and use those apps to share the data as we wish to choose.
You put it in your TED Talk. You want our data to be liberated. In other words, if Verizon or Time Warner or Apple or whoever is collecting all this data on us, okay, but let us see it.
Let me see my data. And actually, I found quite a bit of openness to that notion. If you're a common carrier like Verizon, you really can't use that data and sell it in lots of ways. But the one person you can give my personal data back to is me.
And this is the kind of thing that data brokers also want, you to leave more digital breadcrumbs about your health and everything else. Yesterday, All Things Considered reported on data brokers, and it turns out while most data is incredibly cheap, data about health ups the price. Here's a clip of Emily Steele from the Financial Times.
The more sensitive the data, the harder it is for these data brokers to get their hands on that information. And at the same time, the demand from pharmaceutical companies, marketers, and others to use that information is at a very big high.
So is that a good thing?
I was just about to say, so isn't that a good thing? So that sensitive data, let it come back to me and let me choose with whom and for what I wish to share it. If I have a history of MS in my family, I might share it with the Multiple Sclerosis Foundation.
Or are you just creating a new way for marketers to track us and packaging this data so that it paints a certain picture of our health, which may or may not actually help us?
And so for the most part, these data are already out there. And so these are not so much new data, but I agree. Just opening up this data for individuals to use, just creating apps that will consume them, does not relieve us from the need to renegotiate policies and etiquette and practices, contracts.
Listeners, what are you thinking about Dr. Deborah Estrin's idea of leaving digital breadcrumbs and using data to take our social pulse as well as our actual measured heart rate monitor kind of pulse in ways that could come back to protect our health? Are you being creeped out on a privacy level here, like some of you were with example one having to do with cars just before? Is this something that encourages you? Are you already using some of these devices that do exactly this? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show. Here is Mike in Queens calling in, who says he's a physician. Hello, doctor.
Hi.
What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that Yeah, it's really hard to keep all this data in the hands of private companies that you have no control over. Big insurance companies have all your data on physicians and on patients, and how that data is used is a concern to me. I mean, I recently received a similar to a report card from United Healthcare. My specialty is allergy, and I treat asthmatics, but in reading and delving into that information, that they were scoring me on diabetes, and I can't get across to them that I don't treat diabetes. So how can my costs of treating an asthmatics be higher or lower than somebody when I'm not being evaluated on correct information?
It's a great example of at least you now know what is known. And I understand that you might be struggling to get it fixed. Let's hope that you will. But if
but
you
I
didn't
can't.
Even know what
impossible.
Was known.
Impossible?
Yes, impossible.
Do you object to the fact that you're being measured by the insurance companies at all for your efficiency? Or do you think that's something that might be a good thing for public health and for making healthcare more affordable?
I think it's a very good thing because I feel that I treat my patients cost effectively. But again, it doesn't reflect in what the data that they sent me. So their measurements and my measurements are far apart, and I can't convince anybody of that, how to correct the information. There's no way of correcting the information.
Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it. John in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's your take?
Well, I just wanted to say there's a paradigm of something called the personal clouds, which are becoming a newer thing, which is sort of the idea of a Dropbox for your personal data. And there's a group now called Respect Network, which is growing in popularity along these lines. And I wondered if you guys wanted to chat about that in terms of health data, any data that's available. The trick with it is just there's so many ways that our data is being collected through RFID or sensors as we walk through a smart city. Instead of thinking about how privacy is going to be mandated by anyone else, the logic of personal clouds is that you control how your data is managed and transacted. So I wondered if that made sense.
Thank you. And Dr. Estrin, yeah. You're nodding. So you know this concept of personal clouds?
And I think it's a very important of the element of the ecosystem that we need. First of all, we need to know what is known. And from a creepiness perspective, it's not knowing what's known that I'd say at its element. Even if we can't control how those data are used otherwise, by bringing them into a place where we can make use of them, not because we're staring at spreadsheets and spark lines, but because we're having apps running over them in useful ways for us, I do think it can bring into balance some of the privacy concerns.
And it's funny, since you're talking about not only sharing our data, but being able to have our data that's collected by the different companies, it's odd that our data is open to them, but our data is secret from us. And do you have medical data in mind here primarily, or also shopping data, information searches, all those kinds of things?
So I don't think it's odd that it's available to them, right? It's part of using their service that they collect it, and they improve their service and create new ones based on it.
The contrast is odd.
The contrast is odd. And yes, I am personally and primarily focused on all those other kinds of data that reflect things that are both determinants of and reflect things around our health, from what we put in our grocery cart to what we buy at Walgreens to our activity and mobility, what time we get up and get to work, how much time we spend out of the house. It's the combination of those things can create a very rich functional picture that is creepy when we think of it as being known to others, but can be quite useful in helping to titrate medications or helping on the prevention side.
And you have a trial going on, I understand, with some of those vendors?
We have research pilots going on with colleagues up at Weill Cornell at the Hospital for Special Surgery, looking at chronic pain, rheumatoid arthritis in that context, as well as some prevention work going on in healthier kitchens.
In what context? Like, where do the digital breadcrumbs come into it?
The digital breadcrumbs come into it in that we have apps that run on the phone for the patient participants. And so now a rheumatoid arthritis patient who's trying to titrate her medications and reduce the amount of medications with higher symptoms is able to get back to her doctor a summary of how quickly she gets out of the house in the morning, how ambulatory she's able to be, instead of just saying, well, yeah, since I'm on that new med 2 months ago, I'm feeling, I don't know, about the same.
Rita in Somerset, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rita.
Hi, how are you doing?
Okay.
I was calling to, you know, I'm a medical practitioner. I practice dentistry, but I thought that the HIPAA law is supposed to protect people against such, sharing of information without the patient's consent. So I was wondering how are these breadcrumbs being left behind when the HIPAA law is supposed to make it illegal to share information without the patient's knowledge.
It's a great question. You can't go to even a dentist without signing, 15 HIPAA forms.
Yes.
Protecting your privacy.
Yes. So yes. There are a couple of elements to this. First of all, once the data is actually in the clinical system, it is protected from HIPAA and needs to be, and how it can move beyond that is subject to those regulations. These data that are preclinical that we're now talking about summarizing and bringing into perhaps to being relevant clinical measures aren't yet in the clinical system. They're not yet subject to any regulation.
Sorry, preclinical meaning,
The data traces about what time I'm leaving the house in the morning that I might use to titrate that isn't being captured by my clinician or by medical system. We're talking about an app that might now summarize that data to add it to my medical record. And once it's in the medical record, it becomes protected.
So why can't people who provide this, services for preclinical information, that is questionnaires, shouldn't they be also subjected to the same HIPAA laws? Because this is part of patients' privacy, isn't it?
It's complicated in the sense that HIPAA has caused information to flow less than people want as much as it has protected it. And so HIPAA can sometimes get in the way of people trying to do innovative things in coordinated care because there's so much approval needed to move data around. So HIPAA's a good thing, but we don't want to spread HIPAA necessarily to everything because we benefit from our ability to move data around without as much regulation as well.
Rita, thank you. Do you think HIPAA goes too far? Do you think HIPAA, in the name of privacy, sometimes works against personal or public health?
HIPAA is a law. It doesn't go anywhere. It's how people interpret and use it. And so in that sense, I think
it's a law which requires people to do some things and to not do some things in terms of sharing somebody's health information, right?
But people choose to interpret it as constraining them in ways. And I think that I don't know that the law itself needs to be changed so much as our more careful considerations and about how we actually use it.
George in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. Well, my concern is that insurance companies are there to make money, and they're going to only select the top 1% or the top 1.5% of the insurable people that they are absolutely sure that they're not going to have a risk with, and any risk at all. And also that they're going to charge as much money as possible for those that even have a minimal risk, so that in case of life insurance, for instance, if the insurance company thinks that these factors are going to make you more likely to be an insurance risk, they're going to either deny you insurance or they're going to make your insurance so expensive that you're not going to want to buy it, which means that people who really need insurance to protect their families or protect their homes or give them some kind of financial security for the future aren't going to be able to get it. Somebody whose driving record, for instance, indicates that he doesn't do exactly everything right, well, when he comes along with an insurance claim and an accident, even when the accident isn't his fault.
Why shouldn't that person be accountable for his behavior?
Because if somebody gets hit in an accident, say a reckless driver, a drunk driver hits you, runs a red light and hits you at 80 miles an hour or 100 miles an hour and badly cripples you.
Then you're not at fault.
And you're not at fault. Why should the insurance company hold you responsible because you had a previous record from your black box that you weren't driving exactly according to Hoyle on every situation? It had nothing to do with that particular accident, but they're going to make sure that it pertains to that accident.
George, thank you. And so, Dr. Estrin, one of the dilemmas we came up with when we started planning this family meeting on privacy today was, what if sharing all your health data could cure your cancer or your chronic disease, but pretty much guaranteed you would never get a new job? How can we prevent that from being the trade-off?
It's an excellent discussion. There's no simple answer. We did put in place GINA, which allows us to both capture genomics information but prevents people from using it in employment and insurance discrimination. And we need to adjust with similar practices when it comes to these types of data as well.
Dr. Deborah Estrin is a professor of computer science at Cornell Tech and of public health at the Weill Cornell Medical College and the co-founder of Open M Health. What is that, by the way? What is the M in
mobile.
Open M Health? It's
M
for
mobile.
Mobile. So with devices and tracking your actions as you are mobile in pursuit of preventive health measures.
Correct.
So we've posted her TEDMED video. It's about a 10-minute talk, and it's really fascinating, on our website if you want to hear more about her ideas for small data. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show today, our family meeting on privacy, which we are re-airing. We've talked cars. We've talked about your health. We haven't even brought the NSA into this yet. We haven't brought your teenagers into this yet. We will next hour. But up next, the latest news, live from the WNYC newsroom. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. And it's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on privacy today. What's public? What's private? Privacy in your car, privacy in your health, privacy in the NSA, privacy in the marketplace, privacy in your teenagers. With me now are two guests who think about these topics a lot. Jaron Lanier, computer scientist, musician, and author of the book Who Owns the Future, just out in paperback, and Jeff Jarvis, CUNY journalism professor, blogger at Buzz Machine, and author of the book Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live. Jeff, welcome back. Jaron, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much.
Jeff, you have said you've never found a good definition of privacy. Jaron, you've written that no one knows what privacy is. It can be based on different feelings at different times. So why spend so much intellectual energy on something neither of you can define? What matters?
Why are we here?
Jaron, what matters here? Will you start it off?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for me, the bottom line is the economics of it. And to a degree, what I'd call cognitive diversity. I like the idea that different people are different. And if some people want to share and others don't, I'd like to live in a society where there can be differences. But aside from that, the way we're sharing data was originally supposed to create this egalitarian society where everything would become more efficient and everyone would benefit. I well remember making that claim 30 years ago because, you know, I was one of the early digital idealists who really expected it to work out. But just empirically, I've been seeing it instead contribute to extreme wealth inequality where the people who are able to have the biggest computers to process all that open data are able to calculate advantages for themselves over time that accumulate. And that's something we hadn't foreseen. We hadn't foreseen how even if everybody has access to the same data, there's certain people who will benefit disproportionately from that because they have the biggest computers.
So differentials in power work against what you used to think might be a digital utopia?
Yeah. So, I mean, one example is what happened with the American health insurance industry. And as it happened, I was present for the moment it shifted. It was an amazing moment. I was a consultant to, I won't name it, but the largest American private health insurance consortium. And there was this moment where the CEO was at this retreat and he said, my God, with all of this data, our business reverses totally. Our strategy has to become opposite of what it once was. It used to be that to grow, we had to insure as many people as possible. But now that we can know them as individuals, we'll be more profitable if we insure as few as possible, specifically the ones who need it the least.
And the Affordable Care Act is hopefully a hedge against that.
Precisely.
But, Jeff, your book title, Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live. So are you still a digital idealist, a digital utopian? Do you think privacy is overrated?
No, none of that is true. In fact, in the book I said that the government may portray itself as the greatest protector of privacy, but indeed it has proven out to be the worst enemy of privacy. But I think the casting of this discussion is always interesting. It's always from the viewpoint of privacy, where I think that we also have to talk about the value of sharing, which is part of what Jaron talks about too, is that I think that there is a lot of value in that. You know, you had Dr. Estrin on before talking about health and data and privacy. I've shared my prostate cancer and thus my malfunctioning penis with the world. I got great generosity back from that. It gave me the opportunity to be generous. It was a choice that I made. I want to be very clear about that. It has to be a choice. But I think that we also have to recognize that we have incredible new tools of sharing and openness, and the discussion isn't just about trying to put walls around ourselves.
So you embrace the idea of publicness. You write that in your book. Use that word. We should embrace publicness. Does that stand in opposition to the value of privacy?
Not at all. They're complementary. It's wet and dry, hot and cold. I finally did come to a definition of sorts about privacy and said that it is an ethic of knowing someone else's information. Right? Once I tell you something in confidence or not in confidence, whatever happens to that is now on your shoulders. It's public to that extent. I've lost control of it. And you have to decide. There's a concomitant, I think, ethic of publicness, which is if you know something that could help other people, choosing whether or not to share that becomes a question of generosity at some level. And so if you find in Dr. Estrin's view that you can have a lot of people in one geographic area end up having one disease, you're not going to know that and be able to deal with that if people have not been open to share that, if we don't have the systems and structures of trust to enable that sharing.
This is WNYC FM HD in AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJO 90.3 Toms River 2, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Jaron, do you share his definition of privacy roughly, and do you also value publicness?
You know, it's one of those things where there's a difference between the immediate sphere and the large sphere, you know, between the microeconomics and the macroeconomics. So on an individual basis, there are many cases where sharing works out well for people. But in the larger scheme, it's creating this income concentration. So we have a contradiction. Both things are true at once, and that's the way the world is sometimes. The world can be complicated.
Income concentration?
Right. As I was describing with the health insurance companies that discovered that not insuring people became more profitable once they had more information. And that pattern's been repeated in a thousand other ways. It was responsible for the financial meltdown that led to the Great Recession and so forth. And the thing is, it's a wave that's coming to absolutely every kind of economic activity as the cars become automated and factories become automated or become obsolete. As we have more and more advanced technology, the question is going to become whether people broadly benefit from that. And where this question of privacy mixes with that is if those with the biggest computers are able to calculate this very advanced world for their own benefit, then it'll be a world that really only benefits those few.
But I also think that we have to recognize it's not just economic interests at heart. It's scientific interests, academic interests, journalistic interests. And I think we have to be careful not to imagine that the solution is to control information and control knowledge, control the gathering of it. Especially as journalists, we should be very concerned about that mere idea. Instead, Dana Boyd, who has a wonderful new book out about teenagers and privacy called It's Complicated, taught me the lesson that it's really more about controlling use of information than the gathering of information. Her example is that if I walk in and apply for a job here, you can tell at a glance my age and other things about me. You may not use parts of that information against me. But I can't – we're not Men in Black. I can't put a black pen to your head and make you forget something. And I think we have to be careful about the idea of trying to control the idea of what society should know, what companies should know, what governments should know. We have to control the use. The fact that I make a transaction with Google to tell them where I am so I get value and relevance back. I find the nearest pizza. I do not make a transaction with the NSA that it can follow me everywhere. The knowledge of where I am exists in the world. I can't erase that. But the use of that information and that use of that against me is an issue.
But from your point of view, why not feel okay about what the NSA is doing? Because if they're just collecting or even having access to the phone companies and the computer service companies' metadata, and they're not using it against you unless they can see through that patterning that you're in communication apparently with a terrorist, then why object to what the NSA is doing?
Because there's no transparency into it. When I tell Amazon, my classic example is when I buy my daughter a Taylor Swift CD, the next day on Amazon I feel like a dirty old man until Amazon gives me the opportunity to say, should we use this for future recommendations? And I tell them no. And I give them more data, by the way, in the process. I have a transaction there that I choose to make. I have no transaction, no transparency. There is no accountability for the NSA in the executive, in the judicial, in the legislative. Journalists were shut off. We were left with the accountability of last resort, which was whistleblowers. Hmm. And so that's the issue when it comes to government.
Yeah, I mean, it's here I have to say what you're saying just sounds bizarre to me because I live in the sausage factory and I've sold a company to Google and I've worked with Microsoft and Apple and all of them. And I got to tell you, there's no transparency. You have no idea what they're doing. And there's only an illusion of it because they're consumer facing companies that create that illusion for you. And I speak for all of us. I mean, people love our illusion, but it is theater. It's not real. And you have – the NSA has far more accountability because at least there are methods to talk to it. You have – just as an example, Google employees at Google can't blog freely. You know, there's a tremendous screen around what goes on. And there has to be because the profitability of those companies depends on them keeping their actions with your data secret or our actions.
I know what Google knows about me because I have explicit transactions.
No, you
with
don't.
Them.
No, that's false.
What is it they know about me that I don't know?
The derived correlations between you and the rest of the world. See, that's what.
What does that mean?
Okay. See, the thing is, a batch of static data about you is not that meaningful. What's interesting is how you correlate with the rest of the world because that's how you can make predictions about a person about which ads will have an influence on them or which offer of a loan they'll accept. Or whether you should insure them, whether they should get a job, who they should be dating, all this kind of stuff. And so those correlations are the predictive part, and those are the ones that are hidden from you. So you're under the mistaken belief that the data you are able to know about is the important data, whereas in fact the important data is the stuff you're not able to know about. So I'm sorry to say this.
I would love more transparency of that data. I agree with that, but I also don't think it's some great mystery.
The point is, though, that you don't. If everyone could see it, it would defeat the business plan of this type of business. So you're in a sense a little naive about how big data works.
Well,
I'm sorry to say that.
Some data is made obvious. I mean, the classic example, hackneyed though it may be, is flu trends, where Google reveals the correlative data of what searches there are in flu, and we know that. I would like more transparency.
Although I have to say, I use that in my book as an example of big data being effective, and then all these flu researchers from the CDC wrote to me saying, no, that was a scam, it's not real. I'm not an expert in that area, so I don't know.
Are you talking about things, Jaron, I think this is in your book, about how Google or Amazon or I don't know which companies are doing it will sell information about your searches or what you write in a Gmail to other companies that they can market to you. And that's one of the things they don't reveal.
Well, that's a minor thing. That certainly is happening a lot. And there's this enormous third-party transaction of data about you, which is extraordinarily large.
Which was there before the Internet. Axiom was there knowing a lot about you before the Internet.
That's not the most important stuff either. Mm-hmm. The most important stuff is the statistical calculations that are able to predict and manipulate people reliably on a statistical basis. So there's no particular guarantee that a Google ad will influence you or that a particular big data calculated health insurance decision or loan offer or whatever the hell it is will influence you. But overall, statistically, they do. So it becomes a form of massive behavioral
But this is again where we get back to use, Jaron. This is where the health insurance example is. This is why Obamacare is so necessary because it gives you the right to have health insurance no matter what the data say about you. And so the issue isn't there's data about you. Indeed, I would argue we have to have less stigma about disease, more protection for your employment, more protection for your insurance about disease. And the more we can open up data about disease, the better off society is going to be. The reasons we don't right now are because of those fears about what could happen.
Right. Well, so that's one big question. Another one is just how people make a living in the future. So what we're seeing now is when digital systems optimize the world, they're tending to create what we call ZIP distributions, where there's a very small number who benefit the most. And then there's this huge long tail. It's a current term of art. That's calculated by hidden big data. And so if that stuff was more regulated or revealed or something, there might be a more equitable society. In my book, I've been looking at a completely different way of trying to use open and free markets to try to address the problem by letting people get
paid
for their data.
But you also try to make information a commodity to pay for, and that worries me, actually. just as it were, paywalls around content and journalism worry me as well. The idea that information is something to buy and sell.
Meaning what? That Google and Amazon and so forth should have to buy your data from
you? Yeah, exactly. So I first of all, I agree with you that it's a funny thing about paying for information. If you do a little bit of it, it creates blockages and it creates artificial prevention of benefits. It's a bad thing. But if it becomes universal, I think you could switch into a completely different system where things become more available.
That's called copyright, isn't it?
No. We're in a mess copyright, right now copyright. But copyright is this very, very antiquated sort of one-bit, all-or-nothing system. If we could do something much more fluid and better than that, I think it might actually become more universal.
I think there's a wonderful theory called the Gutenberg parenthesis that says we're returning to an era before Gutenberg. Gutenberg was a grand exception where information was passed around freely. There was very little sense of ownership and authorship. And so I think we're returning to that notion. And trying to put clamps back on in the sense of intellectual property, information property, that property is the metaphor for all this, I think is very dangerous.
Right,
if I'm naive, Jaron, then I think maybe you're trying to exploit it in an entirely new way that's somewhat paranoid about the business of interests.
No. I love the free market. I mean, to me, the problem is it's just like in finance where what's said often and is very true is that we've socialized risk while privatizing the benefits, and that's been the problem. We're doing exactly the same thing with information, where we're privatizing the benefits and creating these incredible instant fortunes for WhatsApp or whatever. Meanwhile, everybody is losing security, losing wealth because we're entering into an informal economy as if we were some favela or slum, and we think it's cool and we think that the pre-Gutenberg world
is... Isn't the answer to that taxation?
Well, that's the redistributionist approach, and that might be the only approach. I'm exploring the alternative of expanding the idea of free markets to try to address this.
But you're doing the opposite. You're clamping down on ownership
and
information.
No. So, see, this is – you're making – the classic argument about free markets is that they actually will create blockages because people won't be able to afford things. But then counterintuitively, sometimes they make things more available. And so the weird thing
– But what about generosity? What about simple generosity? People on the internet now are sharing because they want to share, because they want to connect with people, which is what societies do.
Yeah.
They want to share information and collect their information together in ways that is good for collective society that has nothing to do in that case with markets, and platforms enable that.
Well, you know, either the whole economy has to go sharing or not. I mean, you can't just say that all these people share, but then the people who gather all that sharing information and calculate advantages for it to become super rich immortals, if we're to believe Google.
Uh-huh. So let me jump in for just a second and remind everybody what we're doing here and invite our listeners in to wherever you want to enter this conversation between Jaron Lanier, author of Who Owns the Future, just out in paperback, and Jeff Jarvis, author of Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live. And I'll just keep going on this fascinating conversation because, Jaron, I want to get to something that I know you've written because you think there are two ways to deal with this that are in tension with each other, either regulate for privacy or enforce a radical openness, what you call a universal transparency. And I wonder if you can discuss that one. What would universal transparency look at to equal the power imbalance with respect to information and how people can use it against us?
Well, look, I'm open to all possibilities for a high-tech economy in which a broad range of people benefit. And the only option on the table right now is classic redistribution, which I think is going to be problematic in this new world, because as soon as you redistribute, it'll be concentrated again by whoever has the biggest computers who can calculate ways to manipulate everybody else. So it won't work anymore. It used to. So some of the ideas I'm looking at are super radical openness, where anybody can go into Google's or Microsoft's or Facebook's computers anytime, and there's no longer a hidden dungeon, which there really is right now. You might think it's open, but it's not. That world of genuinely universal openness and universal sharing might work. That was the original idea 30 years ago, and I think an experiment, a limited experiment, would be worthy.
It could never be enforced? What would you have to do that world?
You'd have to have enforcement because it's so tempting. I mean, like, anybody who's experienced the thrill, like when you have a computer that's on the rise, that's gathering everybody's information and giving you an advantage, it feels, I mean, I can't even explain the rush of it. It's amazing because you're suddenly like on top of the world. You can see things that other people can't see. You can see through walls, you know, and it's hard to resist that, so it does need regulation. Another alternative is the one we just talked about, of letting everybody get paid for information. And what might be nice about that is it gives you a gray area. It gives you – right now, like with information, you're sort of – trying to regulate it is really hard because you can't even trace it. But the thing is, accountants are in a way more powerful than police. You know, if there's money at stake, somebody will chase it. And that might create this moderate thing where you can set the price of your information, which equals how much privacy you want, and people can come to different decisions.
And it's the Brian Lehrer Show, privacy, family meeting today, what's public, what's private. Great op-ed in the Times this morning on some of this stuff by Julia Angwin, author of the book Dragnet Nation. And she asks if privacy has become a luxury good. And it seems precisely relevant to what Jaron was just talking about. Let me read a little bit of this. She wrote, "Last year I spent more than $2,200 in countless hours trying to protect my privacy. Some of the items I bought, a $230 service that encrypted my data in the internet cloud, a $35 privacy filter to shield my laptop screen from coffee shop voyeurs, and a $420 subscription to a portable internet service to bypass untrusted connections, protect me from criminals and hackers. Other products, like a $5 a month service that provides me with disposable email addresses and phone numbers, protect me against the legal but to me unfair mining and sale of my personal data." Julia Angwin in the Times today. Jeff Jarvis, you're rolling your eyes.
Yes, I am. Julia was at the Wall Street Journal. She's now at ProPublica. And when she, I think that this is the fruits of her work coming back to her. Because at the Wall Street Journal, she did a whole big series about privacy. It was a bunch of techno panic. Oh, my God, everything could go wrong. All fear, all fear. In the New York Times op-ed today, it turns out pretty much she went after people who were trying to exploit the fear that she helped create. And guess what? She got ripped off. It ended up doing nothing for her. And I think that's part of the issue here is this techno-panic, this idea of techno-panic.
And she does come to that conclusion.
It is. The first serious discussion
not
of the legal—
not techno-panic, but that she couldn't actually protect her privacy by buying her
way out.
She
wasted money on charlatans, pretty much, not all. The first serious discussion of a legal right to privacy in this country did not occur until the year 1890. And the reason was an invention of a technology, the Kodak camera. It freaked people out. We didn't know what to do about it. It took a while for us to negotiate our norms around that. And then, indeed, we did. And now we see people worried that you're going to take your Google Glass into restrooms and take pictures of people's private parts, as if somehow the technology is going to make you do stupid and evil and awful things. We have to have more faith in humanity at some level here, I think.
Suzanne in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Oh, hello. I am utterly horrified, I mean genuinely horrified, at the idea of anyone being able to anonymously aggregate any information about me from any source whatsoever.
Why? They— what are they going to do to you?
Sell it on the fly.
Why?
I believe we have given up our Constitution. This has started with 9/11. It doesn't only have to do with data. We're giving up our privacy. We're giving up the Fourth Amendment. We're giving up any sense of, you know, myself belongs to myself. When did this happen? Why is this happening? It seems to me that we ought to have an opt-in, not an opt-out for all of this, and some way of enforcing it. It's hideous.
Thank you, Suzanne. Jaron, what do you think about these commercial fixes to commercial spying, the kinds of things that Julia Angwin was writing about, products like those, or using the search engine DuckDuckGo, which forgets your searches, or the photo-sharing app Snapchat, which deletes your pictures a short time after you share them? Are these things, if we can afford them all, the way to protect our privacy?
Well, I have to say I agree. They're pretty much fakes. And the thing is, the ones that aren't fakes come under an extraordinary temptation to become part of the problem. Like a great example is there was an ad blocking plugin that was able to, according to reports anyway, extract money from Google and blackmail to let Google's information flow through. So as soon as somebody gets good at blocking the system, then they're the ones with the data, and then there's this huge temptation for them to get rich by being the ones to get advantages from it. So all that happens is the temptation moves from one party to another. Structurally, the problem remains the same, and we simply have to change the structure. We have to undo it.
Why should we care so much about marketers knowing so much about us? I mean, we understand our insurance companies. They could use it against us. We understand employers. We understand the government. How about the marketers? So they show us books and clothing that people like us have been likely to buy in the past. How are we harmed by that?
Well, in any given day, you're not necessarily harmed. You might benefit, in fact, and I think a lot of people do. But in the long haul, what's happening is it's turning the economy into a zero-sum game because, the biggest computers are able to calculate slight advantages over time to manipulate you. And what it does is it undoes the idea of a market where there are a lot of players with independent positions. All of the information gathered forefathers into just a few players who have sort of ideal overviews and can act like market planners. And then what happens is they concentrate more and more wealth over time, and people have less and less opportunity, less and less stability. And that's what we're seeing in our society. And that's the problem. It's a long-term problem. On a day-to-day basis, it might work. And I think it really does for a lot of people.
I think Jaron identifies a problem that I think is actually much bigger. And here we'll agree. Technology leads to efficiency over growth. And we have an economy that's based on the presumption of growth. And instead, look at my industry, journalism. You have more people able to engage in it. There's a surplus of information. There's a shortage of jobs. Those jobs are not going to come back. Same in retail, same in other areas, where it's not just about the data in terms of privacy. It's also about new efficiency, which leads to greater productivity, which leads to greater profitability, which leads to greater wealth, but not necessarily what we would call a fair distribution of that. So we now have, and Jaron's right here, a tech 1%. And the technology companies, I don't think, have dealt appropriately with that in terms of earning our trust.
So Julia Angwin continues in her op-ed today, consider Google, which scans what you write in Gmail to offer advertisers a chance to promote their items based on your missives. Or a visit to an online news site where your data is secretly auctioned and sold before the page loads. Those who aren't bothered by that exchange should keep in mind that our data is not just used for advertisements. It also has been used to charge people different prices based on their personal information. Maybe that's your winner-take-all economy, Jaron. Mm-hmm. It has been used to provide different search results to people based on their political interests. It's been used by the government to identify possible criminal and terrorism suspects.
I argue, Brian, that we actually have to go down that path in media and get better at that. The fact that, for example, podcasts here at WNYC mean that you can start to understand what individuals listen to. Now, you can use that to try to give them greater relevance, greater targeting. I don't care about sports. Don't give me sports. Don't bother me with it. Now, some people might consider that creepy. I don't. I consider that an effort to reduce irrelevance and noise and give me higher relevance. So I think actually media have to learn these lessons. And by the way, you know, the trope now is if you don't pay for the product, you are the product. But that's always been the case in media models. And the truth is Google gives me incredible value back for free. I visited the Google programming staff in Munich where they deal with privacy, and they said that they've had no complaint there, hardly any complaint, about a Google Priority Inbox. Yes, Google reads my email, but so it can also get rid of all the spam, and that's a good thing.
Well, it's very emotional what people decide they'll accept or what they won't accept. And
I think that's condescending to people to call it just an emotional decision. It's a rational decision in a marketplace.
Well, I mean, the Germans are also, hyper-vigilant about Google Street View. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the difference is emotional. And it does because, you know, on a rational basis, a lot of these things are not that different from one another. But where it all comes together, though, is – If you are in all right, let's take journalism. The problem with making journalism free is that the act of journalism is no longer on the books. It's not on the ledger, so we're not seeing it registered as economic growth when we should. I mean, and that might sound
that's a little abstract. That's a problem with measurements. No.
It's a problem of demonetization. It's a problem of forcing things into the informal economy.
I can also, the platforms that enable communities to share information on their own, Brian uses the convening power he has of this show to get his community to share information among themselves. That's really powerful. And he's gotten information that no single journalist ever could have gotten. Yes, it's for free, but it comes out of generosity sharing.
No. But the problem is that, God, I remember when we were starting to do this, and I count myself as part of it, like I said, because I have a company that became part of Google and all this stuff. So I'm part of it. I'm not looking at it from a distance. I'm criticizing myself. But back around the turn of the century, when this whole pattern was getting going, Stuart Brand, one of the Silicon Valley intellectuals, he's a friend and lovely, but you know, he was going around to all of us with these films of the favelas of Brazil and saying, "Look how wonderful it is that they all share in these slums and how efficient it is." And can't we learn a lot from it? And the thing is, at the time, we were all sort of seduced by it because it does...
What's to be seduced by in that?
Well, see, that's the thing. It's like, on the one hand, there are the economy of sharing and reputation and all these things does have its beauty. It has a beautiful human quality because it's depending on human relationships, and there's something very pure of heart about it. And yet, at the same time, there are all these people who don't have security. And you know what I think it is ultimately?
I'm not getting the connection between that and the favela.
No, because that's what we've done to journalism. We've turned journalism into a favela where there's this lovely sense of sharing.
Oh, I don't think so. No.
Oh, it's so true.
I run a program in entrepreneurial journalism. I'm teaching journalists to be greedy capitalists and support themselves.
If you go to a ghetto, the news travels very fast in a ghetto because everybody knows each other. You know,
in the pre-Gutenberg days, you thought the things people said to each other were rumors and the news is what the institutions said. Now we have more faith in the people, and I think that's a good thing.
That is what happened in a ghetto. I mean, in a ghetto, that's like what rapping is or something like that. It was a form of communication for disadvantaged people. We're just doing that to everybody right now. And it does have an authenticity. It does have authorship. It has a lot of good qualities to it. But the key thing here is that tech people are young. Tech people like to think of themselves as immortal. Google is officially exploring immortality now and all of that. And the thing is, if you're going to be immortal, if you're going to be young forever, you don't think about security. You don't think about...
Oh, I think that's condescending too,
Darren. I'm only condescending to myself because I'm part of it.
Well, no, you just took in every tech person and every young person and said they don't care about something. Dana Boyd says that this trope that young people don't care about privacy is absolutely false by the data.
Well, that's not what I said. What I said is that successful young techies think they're not going to die. And I'm sorry, it's true.
I was at the Google strategy group speaking 2 weeks ago.
They think they're not going to die?
Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I remember when actually my friend David Levitt first said that 30 years ago, and we were all – The people who invented this were all together, and we all laughed in self-recognition about how true it is. No, I mean, because we think of ourselves as being like these incredibly powerful, potent people, you know?
I was speaking to the Google strategy group two weeks ago, and I forgot something because I'm 59 years old. It happens. I looked around this room of young people, and I said, don't get old. One of the guys, without missing a beat, said, we're working on that.
Rama in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Rama.
Hi, Brian. I'm a first-time caller, and I love your show.
Thank you so much.
It's really interesting and important issue. I'd like to suggest that the solution for most of the privacy issues, really, would be to prevent companies from selling our information. And the reason I say it, because that kind of solution would still allow people to share information and do all of the wonderful things, as one of your people are saying, but also prevent the amassing of information and the aggregation, the profiling of us, and doing things that could be harmful for us without our knowledge.
You told our screener, I think, that they shouldn't be able to sell our information without permission, which is a bit of a distinction from saying they just shouldn't be able to sell our information.
Right, because I do see there are benefits of sharing information and also sharing information with entities that you want, but as long as we are doing it knowingly. I mean, I would suggest that all or almost all of the benefits from sharing information can be done if we are aware of what's happening and if we give permission for that.
Rama, thank you very much. I'm going to go on to Selena on the Upper West Side. Hi, Selena.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The conversation about privacy being dead because we're all giving it away, that's a false premise. You know, there are young people who are computer literate, who are in STEM fields, you know, who don't use social media because they don't see value in it, who don't buy into consumer culture and, you know, put all their information on Amazon, who don't, you know, do Google searches in their home to protect their privacy. Why do, you know, people like us have to be, you know, subjected to, you know, the same ideas as people who have no problem and think it for the greater good that they can reveal the fact that their penis isn't working. If my penis wasn't working, I wouldn't want society to know this. And
I agree, that's your choice. That's just the point. But there is also a generosity that comes from sharing your health information. Look at what's happened with breast cancer. The fact that that was considered a stigma to even talk about. AOL refused to allow the word breast on its service until women with breast cancer fought back and said, no, we need to talk about this and look at the benefit that has come from that.
And it should be the person's right to disclose.
Absolutely. We agree.
Generosity, your idea of generosity is not my idea of generosity, and I shouldn't be forced into this
No one is saying you should be forced, and as Jaron says, that's about diversity.
You are being forced right now, and the reason you are – well, actually, no, if you're genuinely a STEM student, you're probably smart enough not to be forced, so I want to give you that. But most people cannot possibly understand the privacy settings on the various sites. An ordinary person – somebody who's non-technical, you have to be a programmer to understand your privacy settings on Facebook. It's like decrypting something. And I think even highly technical people simply don't have the minutes in the day to actually manage these things. It's hypothetically possible. In practice, it's not.
But the truth also is, Jaron, the Internet is the wrong place to keep a secret in any case.
Selena, what?
People who are tech savvy enough know, you know, there's a promise that all this data is going to be de-anonymized. The people who are tech savvy enough know that it's easy enough with certain steps to they promise that it will be anonymized, that it's easy enough to actually de-anonymize the data. So when, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are buying up data from our drug stores on data that's supposedly anonymized, you know, there's a reason why they're doing it. They're doing it to sell to us better. I don't want to be sold as better. I don't want my medical condition sold. I mean,
and Selena?
There's a very big problem. You know, people don't even see if it's a chessboard for what's happening with data in our country. People don't even see where we are on the chessboard, let alone 2, 5, 10 steps ahead.
Selena, you get the last word in this segment. Thank you very much. And we thank Jaron Lanier, author of Who Owns the Future, just out in paperback, and Jeff Jarvis, author of Public Parts, How Sharing in the Digital Age Improves the Way We Work and Live. Tag this segment, Privacy, Publicness, Power, Authority, Universal Transparency, and Immortality.
Nothing less than that.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on privacy today. And up next, what's public and what's private for your teenagers? Ever wonder why your teen won't let you in their room but is seemingly willing to share almost anything online? We'll talk about privacy online and off when it comes to teens in the modern world. And spoiler alert, we're not going to solve everyone's teenagers, but maybe we'll walk away with a few extra clues to their public-private mysteries. Stick around. It's the best of Brian Lehrer Show today, so we won't be taking your calls, but you can continue the conversation on our website, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or on Twitter, at Brian Lehrer, or Facebook, where it's Brian Lehrer, WNYC. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting about privacy today. What's public? What's private? Next topic, your kids. We've got two central questions here. How do you and your kids manage privacy online? And how do you find the line in your family about your teen's privacy from you? On the one hand, our kids demand privacy. You can probably tell from the keep out sign on your teenager's bedroom door. At the same time, you really can't believe how much they share with other people on social media. So we'll open up the phones now, and we have a great guest who's going to join us in a second. But we're opening up the phones for your calls on how privacy comes up in your family, specifically with your kids. Is this territory that you're navigating with your teenager right now or you have in the past? There are even definitional differences here. Jeff Jarvis before mentioned Dana Boyd, who I heard give a great talk a couple of years ago in which he said, we don't even define privacy the same way if we're a teenager or if we're a grown-up. So do you define privacy and your kid define privacy in different ways? We'll get into some examples of that. 212-433-WNYC. And we want to hear your specific examples, stories of how you're navigating this territory in your family. What's public? What's private between you and your teenager or teens who happened to be listening, between you and your parents, and between all of you in your family and the social media world. 212-433-9692. And joining me as your calls are coming in is Mary Madden, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. Pew has been looking at how teens interact online for over a decade now, how they think about anonymity and privacy and their reputations and how their parents react as well. Mary Madden, welcome to WNYC. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
And I thought that maybe this would be the segment where we don't mention Edward Snowden, but we read a quote of his that I think you've cited before when talking about teens. He told the Washington Post, "The internet is on principle a system that you reveal yourself to in order to fully enjoy." And I guess that applies to teenagers, right?
Sure. Absolutely. It applies to all of us online. And, you know, I think to speak a little bit to your comment at the top of the segment, you know, parents and teens do often have a different sense of what privacy means online. And I think a lot of that is connected to a different sense of who the audience is and different motivations for sharing or not sharing online.
Yeah, the Dana Boyd quote I was referring to was she was talking about teens on Facebook and then their parents going on Facebook because they can to see what the teens are posting. And the teen gets outraged and says, "You're looking at my Facebook page? That's private." And the parent says, "No, Facebook, that's public."
Well, it's really interesting because a lot of times the information that teens post really does mirror the evolution of the platforms they use. So on the one hand, some of the information that teens are posting to Facebook is technically required by the platform, right? There's a real name rule there. And so we've seen in our research over time that you can sort of track the kinds of information teens are posting in some ways to the norms in the interfaces and how they have changed. But of course, teens are also really motivated by, you know, this opportunity to connect with their peers and spend time in these informal spaces. And so for them, they're very much focused on connecting with their friends and hanging out. In some cases, they are managing their privacy in pretty creative ways where parents sort of assume that they know what their son or daughter is posting about. But in fact, that message may be coded. It may use certain in-jokes that only friends can understand. And so I think that's really where some of the most interesting findings that we see in our research and also in are echoed in Dana's work about how teens are really creating what she refers to as privacy in public. And that's really, I think, where teens are becoming quite clever and innovative in how they create some sense of privacy in these very public spaces.
And it could be that the platform, Facebook in particular in this case, is evolving, because it was 5 years ago that I heard Dana Boyd make that particular remark. And teens can do more to protect their privacy or determine who gets to see which information on Facebook than they used to be able to. And in fact, some of your research goes to this idea that there's a popular perception that teenagers are terrible with protecting their privacy and their reputations online. But you found that that's not so true, right?
That's right. We found that they're quite actively engaged in an array of technical and non-technical measures that they use to manage their privacy on social media. And so, you know, just the basic decision about who to friend, right, is one sort of measure of managing your social privacy online. And when we spoke to teens in focus groups, we heard a lot about that. Also, you know, sort of the rule of thumb about what to post and what not to post. A common refrain was, you know, don't post anything you wouldn't want your grandmother to see, because we all know grandparents are on Facebook now as well. So we see certainly as these networks have become more popular, more mainstream, young people's sense of sort of this being a space of their own has changed. Their worlds have expanded and they are, you know, very much engaged in those reputation management activities as well. You know, deleting content, you know, in some cases deleting their accounts altogether when they find it to be too burdensome or problematic to engage in these spaces.
So does that mean that social media is not actually the genuine social space for teens that it was just a few years ago?
Well, I think the platforms are changing, and certainly we saw some early signs of that in our last survey, which was fielded in 2012, which is a long time ago now, but also in the focus groups we conducted, which happened after the survey. We started to hear from teens, you know, that they were finding Facebook to be quite a public space for them to manage. They expressed a lot of feelings that it was sort of a burden. There was a lot of drama that they were experiencing there. And so instead, they were starting to turn to some of the newer applications, some not so new. Some teens were turning to Twitter. We saw a big increase in teen Twitter usage at the time, 24%, up from 16% the year prior. And also, you know, some of these sort of ephemeral apps like Snapchat that sort of bake in this sense of, you know, a sort of temporary message that sort of is supposed to self-destruct. We know there are creative ways to still preserve those messages. But
ephemeral,
the idea,
in the sense, for people who don't know Snapchat, it's basically a photo sharing site where the photo disappears after a short time. Right.
That's right. And so.
So the college board that's looking at your, the admissions board that's looking at your application isn't going to find that super embarrassing photo you posted when you're 15. That's sort of the point, right?
In theory, yes. Of course, you know, it becomes a game between certain friends to try and preserve those images and then post them to Facebook. But when you're talking about sort of, you know, one-on-one communication with close friends, you know, teens enjoy this because it's a way to exchange sort of, you know, goofy images throughout the day that are not intended to be preserved forever and forever attached to your digital profile. And it also signals a shift to really more of an image-based communication style, that something that, you know, was popularized on social media and is moving now that so many kids have smartphones. You know, it's a way to sort of express yourself through images, you know, in some cases not even, you know, adding any text. So that's an interesting trend that we're watching as well.
Annie in Fairfield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Annie.
Hi. I just wondered if you would comment on this. I have a friend whose college-age son seems like he's depressed and he's always in his room on his computer. And I said, why don't you just check his cookies sometime? Check the history on his computer if you're concerned. And he feels he's breaking his privacy. He's, you know, invading his privacy. And I'd just like to hear you comment on that, because it gets me. You know, you hear these stories like what happened with Newtown and you wonder.
Mary?
So, you know, I think we don't make recommendations at the Pew Research Center about what parents should or shouldn't do. Certainly what we hear from parents is that they are, like teens, employing a wide array of technical and non-technical strategies to help manage their kids' privacy online. And so that can be, you know, everything from setting rules to, you know, engaging in technical monitoring, using, you know, monitoring software. I think certainly it's becoming much more challenging for parents, particularly with the rise of smartphones. And certainly, you know, one of the sort of basic bedrock rules or recommendations from groups that gave advice to parents in the past was simply, you know, put your computer in a shared space of the home. So you can essentially, you know, oversee what your kids are doing online, not necessarily standing over their shoulder the whole
time.
That
was fine before laptops and tablets.
That's right. And that, you know, is simply not an option anymore. And so, you know, in some sense, you know, if you talk to folks now, the reality, you know, tends to be more, you need to equip, you know, kids to be able to navigate these environments wherever they may be, because you can have the tightest restrictions at home and then, you know, your kid goes to school and their friend has, you know, a smartphone without any restrictions. So
to Annie's conundrum about the depressed son's computer and what the parents should do, let's add another caller. Annie's still there, and Anne in Queens, a social worker, is also on the air. Anne, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Working with teenage girls, specifically boys, you know, for societal reasons, don't emote the same way. So girls specifically have this issue now where they're divulging personal information about depression and even suicidality on Tumblr and on online forums in a way that used to be just be in a journal or, you know, something very private that only maybe a parent would see, if even that. And now schools and, you know, school professionals are seeing these posts online because everyone can see them.
For you as a social worker, Anne, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, I don't think it is a good thing. I think that a lot of the time, it's really these kids aren't actively suicidal. They're not mentally ill. They're going through teenage dramas, and it happens daily, weekly, monthly, and they don't understand the repercussions that if the entire school professional staff knows about these little, you know, dramas that maybe are just internal or just amongst a couple of people, and they express them in these really large ways that I don't think they really understand how serious they are, that we all have to jump on board and take it as though it's very seriously. And a lot of kids end up going to these programs, you know, that are really meant for kids in much more serious, dire need.
Uh-huh. So, Annie, maybe that would be the situation if your friend looked at your friend's son's computer. I don't know how serious the situation is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just an ethical line that I was wondering, you know, where, like you said in the beginning of the show, where you draw that line. But I'm gonna take off because I
sure. Annie,
so much thanks, love your show.
Thank you very much. And Anne in Queens, thank you very much. And so, Mary Madden, here's a post from a listener on our website that's relevant. And again, he's quoting Dana Boyd, who said that they create multiple identities, talking about teenagers, they create multiple identities and live multiple secret lives. And John writes, this is absolutely what I've seen. Does your data measure that?
Certainly I think in the focus groups got a little bit at, you know, sort of the sense that teens are compartmentalizing, and interacting with different groups in different spaces, not to the extent that they were developing entirely different personalities. But certainly I think, it's interesting to sort of step back and think about how we all do that in offline spaces as well. And so one sort of thread of discussion around what changes in online spaces is that oftentimes contexts that are offline quite separate get collapsed and condensed and mushed together online. And so, you know, I think in some sense it's expected that, you know, teens would want to compartmentalize much in the same way that adults do with their professional and personal lives online. So I think that flexibility and fluidity is certainly something that's not going to go away anytime soon.
Nancy in Long Island City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Nancy.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Okay.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I just want to make a quick comment in regard to the fact that I think that kids today do not really understand the dramatic repercussions that come from these multi-devices that they're using now. I have three girls. My youngest is 17, who most recently posted something that what I considered not appropriate. It was amazing to me that she really, really didn't understand what was going to happen because this was now something that was available on a permanent basis.
What did you think was going to happen, and what did she think was going to happen?
Well, what I think is going to happen is that that is something permanent that may come up in her future at some point when, say, she's a candidate for a good job at IBM and somebody decides that they want to look at something that she did at a much younger age. She didn't think anything of it. Girls do this now. It's not that big a deal to have a semi-nude picture of yourself and send it maybe to your boyfriend, and because some sophisticated young kid knows how to screenshot it off of Snapchat, you know, which is, this is stuff that we never dealt with. We never had this in our generation.
Does she not have a privacy concern, or how did she react if you brought it up?
I don't think a privacy is really a question for her. I think it's more like everybody does it, and, you know, it's not that big a deal. And she really, really believed this. Now, she's the youngest, and as I was saying earlier, her two older sisters had phones and devices of the like at an older age. I have a daughter who's 21 and one who's 19. They got their phones at 8th or 9th grade. Haley's had a phone since 4th grade. And I think that the fact that these kids have this instant gratification stuff, it makes them not really aware of a lot of important safety factors around them.
Let's add to this conversation a dad whose kids are a little bit older, JP in Brooklyn. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. So is your story relevant to what Nancy was just telling?
Well, my sons grew up with relatively unfettered internet access when they were teenagers, but this was before social media. So we drilled it into them that you never give out anything traceable back to you on the internet. You always keep yourself anonymous. No personal information ever. And now social media has become the dominant thing on the internet, and they hardly even participate. They're just not interested in it.
Because it seems too, because they're in their 20s and it just all seems too public to them?
They're just not, it seems silly to them, I guess. But, you know, to your caller's point, maybe if everybody is out there posting semi-nude pictures of themselves these days, it's not going to be a big deal in the future because, you know, paradigm's going to change. And, yeah, of course, everybody did it, so who cares?
Maybe. Well, let's hope. JP, thank you. And Nancy, thank you, unless there's anything else you want to say in response to that.
No, I just, you know, I have to be very aware of it now. It's really grasped my attention. And like your other caller was mentioning, I did have these discussions with my children, and they did have guarded safety nets on all of the things that they started with. I think they started with MySpace, you know, before Facebook became the big ticket. My two older girls, Facebook is dead as far as they're concerned, and Twitter and Snapchat are what they communicate on. And Vine is another big one. You know, everybody does the 6-second
videos. Short video loops. Nancy, thank you very much. And Mary Madden from the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. I think you're a paradigm shift person, right? You see from your research the paradigm shifting. And I don't know if it's shifting in the direction of what JP, the dad, said, that, gee, if everybody does that now and they're 17, it's not going to be seen as so scandalous when she applies for that job at IBM down the road, or what do you think?
Well, it's interesting. We actually find that adults are just as likely as teens to share the suggestive photos. And so adults certainly aren't immune to making those choices. But we see, you know, I think even just in the span of looking at teens ages 12 to 17, you know, there are very considerable changes in their behavior, you know, from the age of being, you know, say 13 to 17 when they are about to go to college. And so some of the behavioral changes amount to getting comfortable with the platform. So new users we see, you know, tend to be much more experimental in their usage, and they first, you know, observe a lot, and then they post a lot, and then they figure out what the norms are in the space. And so we see that teens, you know, who are getting closer to college are much more likely to delete content, to, you know, say that they regret something that they have posted. And so I think that, you know, right now we are in a period where there's a pretty big gulf between, you know, parents and kids with respect to sort of understanding how they are sort of obligated to navigate in these spaces. I think, you know, when schools are starting to require that some students, you know, participate in these spaces, maybe they have to, you know, be on Facebook because their class is on Facebook, for instance. You know, it's not really an option to opt out in every case. So, you know, I think some people say that in the future we simply will become more forgiving because, you know, for some kids, it simply wasn't a choice. They had to learn how to function here and at a time in their lives when, you know, they're very much focused on connecting with peers and not so much on, you know, the permanent sort of gaze of institutions in their lives.
It's our Brian Lehrer Show family meeting about privacy today. What's public? What's private? Our questions on the table right now. How do you and your kids manage privacy online together? And how do you find the line in your family about your teen's privacy from you? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We continue in a minute. It's the Best of Brian Lehrer Show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's the Brian Lehrer Show family meeting about privacy today. What's public, what's private? By the way, be sure to go to our website and take our 6-question privacy conundrums quiz. We're asking you about a few scenarios that test the limits of your privacy and your tolerance and ask how comfortable you are sharing information of different kinds. Take our 6-question privacy conundrums quiz at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Right now we're talking about your family and online privacy and privacy between your teens and yourselves, if you're the parents of teens, with Mary Madden, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. And Mary, I see that last year you surveyed teens on where they turn to for help managing their online privacy settings. And some of your findings, 42% have asked a friend for advice on managing their privacy online, 41% have asked a parent, 37% asked a sibling or a cousin, 13% went to a website for advice, 9% asked a teacher, and just 3% have gone to, some kind of other. So what's the advice that they get back? Does it vary by which of these kinds of folks is giving it?
Certainly, I think it does, and that's not a question that we asked in our survey. We didn't get to follow up on the kinds of advice specifically. But, I think that it's interesting to me to see that teens are just as likely to turn to their friends as they are to their parents. And that really gets to, the extent to which teens are navigating these spaces and getting support from each other, figuring out questions sort of on the fly in these spaces. A lot of it is, trial and error and figuring out, what works, what doesn't. And I think some of the sort of, differences between the fears in these spaces for parents and kids, in some cases, kids, are quite confident that they can figure it out. And they don't have the same sense of messing up because they don't have sort of yet the same, fears around a mistake that will be, forever impacting their lives. And so that may not actually be true, but they're in there sort of making these tweaks in these spaces to figure out, oh, if I, restrict in this way, will so-and-so see it? If I post this content, will it push up my post even higher in my friends' feeds? And so they're sort of learning to game the system in ways that I think adults aren't necessarily always savvy to.
Emerson and Weston, you're on WNYC. Hi, Emerson.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Well, I wanted to make the point that I'm the father of two teenagers, twins at 13, and I think some of the problem that we're having is that as an adult population, and I'm of the baby boom generation, it's difficult to advise them on the technical privacy part when it's hard for us to understand it ourselves for many people. And I think that...
In fact, let me jump in because, Mary, that was another one of your findings, wasn't it, that teens actually understand how to use the privacy settings on Facebook, for example, better than we tend to think they do and better than their parents?
Well, they're quite confident in their ability to use these settings. However, we also found in focus groups that, teens may not have a very good sense of who can actually access their information online and that they were actually quite surprised that advertisers, could gain access to some of their behavioral data and target advertising to them. So their confidence, I think, stems from a sense that they can manage the social aspects of their privacy in these spaces and what's visible, but not necessarily what's going on underneath the hood.
And Emerson, you're looking for advice?
No, I'm not. I'm pointing out what I think is the issue that we should be teaching our children about privacy as a concept, over privacy in a practical terms as far as what they're sharing on a daily basis. That's important too. But it's the concept of privacy and the feeling that we have an ambiguous position in our nation now about privacy that we need to define to our children the importance on a personal level and what privacy means.
Emerson, thank you. And Claire on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Claire.
Hi. I think the expression that we use with teens often is they don't know what they don't know. And I think a lot of teens have no sense of danger
whatsoever until probably they're above the age of 25. So how to communicate with your teen or even younger girls. I run a health club on Long Island where we do social media education for girls as young as 8 years old. How to convey to these young minds that have no sense of danger and a complete sense of immortality that what they're doing could really screw up their lives and put them in grave danger.
Thank you. And that's the constant challenge, you're saying. Bannon Nyack, you're a senior now in high school applying to college?
I am.
Did you have to scrub the internet of anything?
I just wanted to kind of share my thoughts being part of the demographic in question. A lot of my friends are changing their names on Facebook to less descriptive, less like not their real name, in order to kind of veil themselves from admissions.
A 15-year-old told me recently, I don't care what I post on Twitter because everybody changes their name senior year anyway. You think that's true?
I think that to a degree it does change a little bit, but a lot of people aren't aware that they're still connected to the their face and their picture is still connected to the account, and it's still
so
open.
So be careful out there.
Yeah.
Ben, thank you. And Mary Madden, thank you. Senior researcher at the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project.
Thanks, Brian.
And that's our family meeting on privacy on The Brian Lehrer Show.